This program is brought to you by the Genesis Communications Network, a world leader in talk radio since 1998. Visit GCNlive.com today.
Welcome back to the Paracast, the gold standard of paranormal radio. And now, here's Gene Steinberg.
That is not one of Tim Swart's 27 and a half voices. That's Micah Hanks. How many voices do you have, Micah?
Well, if I told you, my psychiatrist would want to talk with me again. So I really, that's going to have to remain classified as well.
But in terms of shapes of UFOs and wondering what they look like, one shape that always seems mysterious, or maybe it's not mysterious, triangular UFOs. That's one that we've looked at over the years. I know early on in the history of the Paracast, we had a forum member who managed a section on triangular UFOs. It's called the Black Triangles Forum. And the guy who set it up was a guy named Tom Levine. And we haven't heard from him in probably 15 years. But he made a big deal about the various objects that were shaped in this fashion. And you kind of wonder what that significance is, because they keep recurring.
Well, I guess we could say that within the already fairly lengthy history of UFOs, there is a lengthy history of sightings of these triangular objects. I recall seeing a brief entry by Brad Steiger in Fate magazine, maybe going all the way back to 1976 or maybe even earlier than that. But, I mean, it was describing sightings of triangular-shaped objects. Of course, David Marler, in his book Triangular UFOs, An Estimate of the Situation, he also goes back in time and provides some historical accounts that seem to also support, if nothing else, that people were seeing triangular shapes in the sky. Some might even go further back, and this is pretty speculative, but if we look at those engravings from Nuremberg, this is one that's famously cited by the proponents of ancient astronaut theories and things like that. All kinds of aerial phenomena appearing in the sky, but you probably know the particular engraving I'm talking about because there's this large kind of spade-like object that's in the sky. And I'm sure that there are modern proponents of the existence of these large black triangles who would look at that and say, see, these things were being seen over Nuremberg back in the 1500s. Now, we may never know exactly what that object in that engraving represents, but I'll tell you what I do know is that, I mean, for the last more than a decade, I personally have received more reports of sightings of those objects than any other UFO or UAP shape or type. The military seems to kind of have a fixation on spheres and things, and they say these little nondescript objects. I'm not so sure that those are the most common types. I think that, if anything, probably since the Navy and other branches of the military began to update their radar systems, Raytheon began to provide phased array radar systems, the Atflir targeting pod was also put into use. With the incredibly advanced equipment upgrades that began occurring in the early 2000s, and this, of course, roughly coinciding with when these UAP events began to occur, really we might appropriately call them UAP detection events, because my contention would be that these objects have been around for a while, maybe forever for all we know, but we now are becoming more technologically adept. We are better equipped at detecting these things. As far as eyewitness sightings, when common people have said they've seen UFOs, I've gotten more reports of the large triangular UFOs than any other kind. It really is striking to me how consistent those reports are. It's always a very large object, sometimes described as about the size of a football field. Some would say about 90 feet long, but again, we're in the same kind of ballpark there. They're generally described as silent moving. They move slowly sometimes. Most often, I think people actually would say that they move at a moderate or a slow speed. Some, in very rare instances, say that they've seen these things take off at incredible rates. As far as conjectures about what these things might be, Gregory Pope was his name. Different Pope, one also associated with UAP and unidentified flying objects. But Greg Pope, writing for Popular Mechanics back in the 1990s, had done a lot of investigation into the sightings of these things, especially out over the Antelope Valley, which is an area that is kind of renowned for tests of experimental different types of aircraft and things. And it's hard to think that if a lot of sightings were emanating from that area at the time, that there weren't some actual experiments underway. But as far as the idea of experimental aircraft, the problem that we encounter with the sightings of these large triangles is that people have seen these in the United Kingdom. I've received very good reports from people in the UK, in Australia, in the United States, of course. I've even spoken to some people in parts of the Eastern world. One man had had a vivid encounter where he and several friends watched one of these things for more than half an hour in China, he said. If these are indeed some kind of a special ops, you know, some sort of a secret U.S. project, why they are seen flying in the airspace of so many other countries really baffles me, unless there is something much more to the relationships between these countries and the reasons for the deployment of an aircraft like that.
Well, that makes me think, though, of the whole Belgium UFO flap, where predominantly the UFOs seen were triangle in shape, where the sightings were predominantly triangle shape. And there was also very good old footage of radar hits taken from a military plane of one of those UFOs.
Indeed, yeah. I mean, really, the Belgium wave from the early 1990s, many would probably recognize as one of the most striking situations where there were multiple sightings of these objects, one of the earliest also, too. That involved a significant number of these. And the fact that this was occurring over Belgian airspace, I think some French authorities had been looking into this at the time, and certainly this got the attention of the UK, probably in other nations nearby. But one has to wonder exactly if this was a U.S. special project, what these aircraft would have been doing in Belgian airspace at that time. Again, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me, but the worldliness of this phenomenon is, again, problematic if we are to conclude that, well, these are probably ours. Now, they very well may be, but if that's the case, again, there's a much deeper question that needs to be asked in terms of how these aircraft get all over the place, first in terms not only of the geopolitics, but even just in terms of, you know, fuel sources and things along these lines. And I would extend that question, in fact, to some of the more recent encounters by the U.S. Navy. There have been some credible arguments made that, you know, foreign governments and adversarial technologies, drones, things along these lines, may be behind some of these UAP encounters, and that their purpose is essentially to gauge the efficacy of our radar systems and detection apparatus on board these carrier strike groups. But the question there becomes one of, well, you know, if I'm flying a drone, all right, a civilian drone, I've got a battery life on this thing of about 15 minutes. Even with a military drone, I mean, if China is operating these things, home base for these drones presumably is going to have to be pretty close by. That or they're going to have to be secret operations nearby, you know, a submarine or something from which these can be released. You're not going to be able to fly those drones all the way from mainland China. And nobody has said that they are. But again, we do have to account, if we're going to say that these are potentially foreign adversaries, for the locations from which, at least in the near term, these drones or other kinds of surveillance platforms are being deployed. Unless there is some kind of extremely advanced technology that has overcome even the simple issues of fuel sources, that is capable of deploying these things and getting them out there and making them available to surveil our naval servicemen and women during these training operations, both in the Atlantic and the Pacific, as has reportedly occurred. Again, there are a lot of questions. And that is the problem that I think that we encounter. If we go back to Ryan Graves' account of some of the objects that were seen between maybe the summer of 2014 and early 2015, in service to the USS Theodore Roosevelt, and this, of course, reported by the New York Times back in 2019. Much has been said about it since. He was saying some of these objects would hang out there all day. He said, you know, if we've got anything like that in the airspace, we've got maybe an hour, maybe. And he said these things would be out there all day. What kind of fuel source is keeping these things aloft? What is keeping these objects out there almost constantly? But then on the other side of that question, and, you know, Bob Schaefer, who's been on the program in the past, has raised this question. If these objects are virtually seen all the time, they're out there all day, and they remain in the sky as though they don't need any kind of conventional fuel source, why don't we have an abundance of video? I mean, why aren't there photographs just coming out our ears of these objects that you can just go out there on any day and see? You know, it's been made out as such that these aircraft appear very frequently. Shouldn't there be more data in support of that if indeed that's occurred? So there are a lot of problems with this discussion about, you know, where these things come from and the simple explanations of they're either theirs or ours, that meaning Russia, China, or the U.S. To me, something much more complex is probably going on.
We'll get into solutions, possible answers to the UFO enigma in our next segment with Micah and Gene and Tim. You're in
the Paracast.
Hey, listeners. I want you to have the entire Paracast experience. So I'd like to tell you about After the Paracast. After the Paracast is an exclusive feature for subscribers to the Paracast Plus. With After the Paracast, you never know what's going to happen next. After the Paracast features color commentary, special interviews, and further conversations with Paracast guests. With Paracast Plus, you can download a very special enhanced version of the Paracast also. We do offer exclusive music, videos, and more features are coming. To get more info about subscribing, please visit theparacast.plus. Once again, theparacast.plus. Prices are just $1.50 a week, less than a cup of coffee at your local convenience store. Check out theparacast.plus to learn more about Paracast Plus.
Hi, Peter Vaccaro for ParanormalDate.com. Are you looking for love in all the wrong places? Now you have a chance to change that by signing up for free at ParanormalDate.com. This incredible dating site puts people of like minds together. People who are interested in the strange, the unusual, mysteries, ghosts, UFOs, and the afterlife, and so much more. ParanormalDate.com was developed for you, people seeking a viable alternative to the other dating services. You can join for free by going to ParanormalDate.com, and if you decide you like it and want to connect with people, use the code GEORGE for a substantial discount. Mark Rawlings, president of ParanormalDate.com, says so many people hunger to share their experiences about the paranormal, the unexplainable, or the afterlife, and so much more, and this is the source for them to meet and share that common interest. So sign up for free at ParanormalDate.com, ParanormalDate.com, and use the code GEORGE if you decide to connect with someone you like.
GCN's policy is open forum, avoiding censorship. Defense costs for words spoken outside of our control supersede the ability to deliver voices to this important talk platform. The First Amendment is the foundation of our core values. Cancel culture is silencing voices regardless of perspective. Freedom to speak is in the balance. Support the legitimacy of speech itself. Consider donating to SaveGCN.com. That's SaveGCN.com.
Airlines have just reduced their prices even more. Book 30 days in advance and save big.
Want the absolute lowest prices on your airline tickets? Then call the low-cost airlines travel hotline right now for prices so low we can't publish them anywhere. The only way to access our low rates and save up to 70% is to call. Save hundreds on your vacation tickets by calling right now. You can fly anywhere in the world and pay discount prices on your airline tickets. Book a flight today to London, Paris, Madrid, or anywhere else you want to go, and pay a lot less guaranteed. Call the International Travel Department right now at Low Cost Airlines.
802-341-4535. 802-341-4535. 802-341-4535. That's 802-341-4535.
Are you curious about what might be missing from your diet and supplement choices? Take a free health assessment to identify your possible nutrient deficiencies. As a certified holistic health coach, I will help you assess and prioritize a supplement program based on Dr. Wallach's recommendations. Call Linda at 833-VITAL-90. That number to call is 833-848-2590. That's 833-VITAL-90.
We'd like to hear from you. If you have a comment or question about the Paracast, send it to news@theparacast.com. That's news@theparacast.com. And don't forget to visit our famous Paracast community forums at forum.theparacast.com.
With that last stinger, I thought for a moment that Tim was going to attempt a Porky Pig imitation.
But I don't have that stuttering capability. I'd be afraid I'd get stuck in it too for the rest of the show.
Well, that's the plan, of course, the game plan. You'd be speaking to us from a tube. Okay. Not in a tube is Micah Hanks. He's in Brazil. And so far we've had pretty decent internet connections, but I'm not going to say anything. Micah, looking, I guess, now into answers to the UFO enigma and the fact that they do things that our craft can't do, and it's simple to say, okay, someone on another planet is 1,000 years ahead of us. And so whatever they do is magic. Do we need to go any further?
That's a good point because, you know, again, just as I was looking at some of the problems with assuming that all of these UAP sightings are simply ours or they belong to an adversarial nation like China or Russia, I don't doubt that there are some instances where that is probably the case. But then there are some instances where that seems increasingly unlikely based on the apparent technology in question or what has been observed. The long-held conjecture that, well, some of these things therefore must be from outer space. They must be extraterrestrials. Some have tried to make the same argument, or at least a very similar argument to what I was making in the last segment, that, you know, or with regard to limitations of fuel and transportation, if it's hard for China, in other words, to get a drone out to the middle of the Pacific to watch, you know, a U.S. naval carrier strike group in operation, imagine how difficult it would be for, you know, for instance, aliens from Zeta 2 Reticuli to send their quote-unquote drones all the way to Earth to observe our technological capabilities, keep tabs on our nuclear sites, and things like this. It's sad because in the modern dialogue about this phenomenon, a lot of people seem to want to kind of frame this in terms of, well, if these things are anything exotic, we have to be open to the possibility that they are unpiloted, you know, drones that are either, you know, automatons in the sense that they are self-piloted, perhaps they're artificially intelligent, or maybe these are just remotely controlled from elsewhere, and these are technologies that don't represent the intelligence itself but are being, in, you know, controlled by it. Either of these, you know, may be the case, but if we go back in time and we look at some of the very credible-sounding UFO events from years past, there are a number of instances where people have claimed not only to see these exotic craft, but also in some cases they've been landed and the occupants have been observed. On my podcast, I recently did an episode where I went back and I tried to look at some of the most credible landing cases from over the years involving individuals who said that they saw the occupants of this craft. Now, keep in mind, I wasn't looking at abductions, you know, the popular abduction claims that kind of dominated the UFO narrative back in the 1980s and into the 90s. These were cases that involved people who said that they saw, for instance, a landed craft and a, you know, humanoid occupant appeared to emerge from it. One example that really was striking to me had actually been recorded by Robert Grebel, the original operator of the National UFO Reporting Center before Peter Davenport took over. And an individual had called in and had been part of a kind of a unit that was working out, I think it was in the state of, I believe it was Utah, if memory serves. And he was part of this unit that was operating out of the state one evening. And he said that he and 10 other individuals had gotten reports of this object that had landed out in this field. And so he says that they go out there and they're observing the object. They see it land. And he said that several of us from different vantage points along the highway, as we were observing this object through binoculars, several of us saw very clearly some sort of a humanoid come out of an opening on the side of the craft, step down, walk out into the field. And then the object later takes off. They said it rose up and then just zipped up very quickly and silently, but they never saw the occupant get back on board. And so they were a little concerned about the fact that whoever came off this craft seems to have emerged and didn't get back on board, at least from what they could see when this thing took off. Now, at the distance and in the visual conditions under which this humanoid was seen, that, you know, was essentially all that they were able to determine, that this was a humanoid. But again, there were a lot of sightings, especially during the 1970s like this, where people who seemed to be, I mean, people, members of law enforcement, people who had been involved with the military, some people just civilian observers, but who just happened to have these experiences where they were able to see occupants on board these craft. Many people describe humanoids. They vary somewhat, and sometimes they're fairly indistinct. Sometimes they're very clearly the kind of modern archetypal gray, or what you might call, you know, the common conception most of us have of an alien. More often than not, they're fairly indistinct, and really there's little detail given apart from just to say that they are humanoid. again, we come back to the idea from earlier that, look, you know, a lot of people make up stories. A lot of these stories probably are too incredible to believe. But if one of those accounts is accurate, it seems to indicate that there are individuals of some kind. We don't have to make any kind of claim as to their provenance, but that there are individuals who are piloting some of these things. They aren't just drones. They aren't just, you know, automatons that are artificially intelligent, what have you. I mean, I'm very intrigued by those old reports. And here again, a lot of that data from outside the military, you know, collected by civilian investigative groups, that data, I think, does at times warrant attention if we are really truly going to try and assess the modern UAP situation. And yet, instead of looking at all of these reports and saying, okay, well, you know, let's at least withhold judgment, but look seriously at these and entertain some possibilities, this preoccupation people have with, if it didn't come from the government, if the United States government didn't release it in a FOIA request, or if it wasn't leaked by somebody, and if one of maybe a handful of authors who are kind of leading this narrative right now didn't write about it, then we aren't interested. I'm thinking, you know, some of the most important data that we've probably collected about this phenomenon in the big picture sense of things is being completely overlooked and ignored by modern researchers due to their preoccupation on what they think is the most important data we have on UAP.
What bothers me is just hearing a report of an object landing, something, we'll say humanoid, don't know how close to being human that is, lands, leaves the craft, and it's not like the movie E.T., although it reminds you of that, and they're not taken away. They don't go back to the craft. It's like the craft took them on a trip like a bus. It goes to the bus stop being Earth, and the entity leaves and gets on about its business, whatever that is.
You do hear those accounts. I recall Stan Gordon doing a lot of investigations that involved sightings of unusual humanoids in close proximity and in conjunction with UFO sightings, which we won't get into right now. But again, the main point that I want to try and drive home is that there's a lot of data over the years that seems very strongly suggestive of there being occupants on board some of these aerial phenomena. There might be a number of interpretations, and we could go down the list. I mean, time travelers, alien visitors, what have you. But I mean, the two most likely, in my opinion, would probably have to be, if we're seeing humanoids, that these are either humans, or if they don't resemble humans, but they are clearly humanoid, they are something else, probably not human, and therefore in likelihood from someplace else. Some might say, how do you know that they aren't, again, like from the future, time travelers from the future? What if they're time travelers from the past, for all we know? What if they are an indigenous crypto-terrestrial group that have been here all along, and they've been here for longer than what we recognize as Homo sapiens sapiens? I mean, we can go down the list.
Got more to come with Micah, Gene, and Tim. You're in.
Hold the podcast.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Visit GCNlive.com today.
Hi, I'm Dan Pilla. I started fighting the IRS over 40 years ago when they tried to seize my mother's house. I sued the IRS and won. I beat the IRS then, and I've been beating them ever since. I wrote the book on tax debt settlement, and I've helped thousands of people deal with tax problems they thought might never be solved. I can help you too. If you owe taxes you can't pay, don't wait another day. There's no such thing as a hopeless tax case. Call 800-34-NO-TAX or go to my website, danpilla.com. That's danpilla.com, danpilla.com.
Silver has always been nature's very own antibiotic, and only one system allows you to generate an endless supply of natural silver solutions, silverlungs.com. You'll find no wild claims or pseudoscience, just a lifetime of nano-sized pure silver solutions. The Silver Lungs generator allows you to make your own, so stop paying for silver solutions. The unique lung delivery system targets respiratory infections where other silver solutions simply cannot reach. See the Silver Lungs generator and lung delivery system at silverlungs.com. That's silverlungs.com.
USA Radio News with Kenneth Burns.
Another mass shooting, this time in Columbia, South Carolina. It happened Saturday afternoon inside of the Columbiana Center. Columbia Police Chief Skip Holbrook says three people are in custody.
This is still early. We don't believe this is random. I think that's very important in situations like this. We believe that the individuals that were armed knew each other. And there was some type of conflict that occurred that resulted in gunfire.
10 people were hit by gunfire. 2 others were injured as people tried to escape. there were no fatalities reported. The $50,000 reward leading to the suspect in Tuesday's shooting at a Brooklyn, New York subway station will be split among five people. The information led to the arrest of the suspect, Frank R. James. The 62-year-old is being held without bail in a federal detention center. No one was killed in that attack, but 10 people were shot and 19 others were injured. This is USA Radio News. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson and other senior British politicians are banned from entering Russia. Officially, it's in response to what it called the UK's unprecedented hostile actions over the war in Ukraine. Russian leaders have placed similar bans on American, Canadian, and European leaders. Some employees at Verizon stores in Washington State have decided to unionize Friday. The stores in Everett and Linwood, north of Seattle, are the first unionized Verizon stores outside of New York City. The Everett Daily Herald reports employees and supporters watched the vote count on Zoom. The paper did not get a comment from Verizon in regards to the vote. 57-year-old Richard Bernard Moore, convicted of the 1999 killing of a convenience store clerk in Spartanburg, South Carolina, has opted for a firing squad when he is put to death later this month. Moore is the first prisoner in the state to face the choice of execution methods after a new law went into effect last year, making electrocution the default option after it was not able to secure drugs for lethal injection. You're listening to USA Radio News.
You trust your mother, right? She's always taken care of you and always tried to give you good advice when you ask for it. And sometimes, even when you don't. Well, even though she might not mention it, Mom very likely has neck, back, and shoulder pains. And she needs relief. So trust this good advice. Give back to Mom this Mother's Day with quality products from Sunnybay. Like our disposable heat patches. They're back in stock now and target neck and shoulder pain in adults of all ages. Or our extra long neck heating pads. They provide soothing relief to painful sore necks and backs. Mom can heat them in her microwave, and they come in a variety of colors and patterns. Read our trusted, authentic, and real reviews on Amazon when you search Sunny Bay Heating Wraps. And shop now in time for Mother's Day. There's no shipping delays from Sunny Bay. Find us on Amazon, Walmart, Etsy, and sunny-bay.com. Remember, just search for Sunny Bay Neck Wraps. Order now because stock is high and shipping is fast. From Sunny Bay.
Hi, this is James Fox. You're listening to the Paracast, the gold standard of paranormal radio.
Of course, if you follow Star Trek, most of the beings they encounter are humans. Okay, Vulcans have the ears and Klingons have the stuff on their foreheads. But whatever it is, they're fundamentally human. They can mate with human beings. Okay, so remember, Mr. Spock is the spawn of a human mother and a Vulcan father. That's the concept. Now, you have these situations where they've discovered extrasolar planets, and of course they're looking for the Goldilocks planet, the one with Earth-like conditions. So if they have Earth-like conditions, how would life evolve? Is the human race a matter of happy accidents, deliberate genetic manipulation by ET, or what? And if similar species evolved on other planets, maybe it's the most logical one for advanced technology, well, then we would expect that our visitors look like us substantially.
You know, Gene, every couple of years there seems to be a new study that comes up from a, I'll put up air quotes, from an expert. And that's not to say that there aren't some very, very talented biologists and physicists and astronomers who weigh in on this. But when it comes to the ideas about extraterrestrials, what form they would really take, what evolutionary path they would have followed to get there, I mean, there are people who are experts only so far as what we can expect based on our encounters with life on Earth, right? To try and say somebody is an expert on alien life is an almost absurd proposition considering how much bona fide extraterrestrial biology we have encountered and that is known to science and that is, you know, removed from the realm of conjecture. So all of that said, every couple of years I'm always chuckling when one of these studies comes out and says, you know, a scientist has now argued that it is most likely that if we encountered aliens, they would resemble humans. They would indeed be humanoid because evolutionarily this is simply the shape that makes the most sense. And then, you know, another 2 years comes along somebody who's saying, no, it's impossible that evolutionarily an intelligent, advanced life, if humans were ever to encounter it, you know, There's no chance that it would resemble us. There's almost no likelihood that they would have followed the same evolutionary path of life on Earth and therefore would be recognizable to us in terms of what life we are used to experiencing here and encountering on this planet. The real takeaway for me there is that we don't know. We have no idea. And virtually every argument has been made and every counter-argument has been made in a perpetually contradictory fashion. And so what I try to keep in mind when I look at some of these UAP encounters where people have seen, you know, individuals outside the craft. A good example, you know, one to kind of gauge this by, I would say, is the Socorro, New Mexico encounter of Lonnie Zamora. It's a very non-sensational case. Here we have a police officer. He saw this craft that was landed, which really in a lot of ways kind of resembles the so-called Tic Tac. He sees them from a distance, but he observes two occupants that are outside the craft on the ground. And although it's at a distance, he is able to see from body language that they appear to be a little startled when he noticed them. And they somehow get back on board the craft. He didn't see how they actually went on board. He didn't say they climbed up a ladder and there was this hatch that they had to screw open and then shut behind them. You know, I don't think that Lonnie Zamora got a close enough look that he saw how they got back on board that craft. But when he described them, he said they were humanoid. And they were kind of small. From the distance that I saw them, they appeared to be kind of smaller. I initially thought maybe they were teenagers. And, of course, he also thought that the craft he was looking at, given his somewhat limited frame of reference, he had never seen a UFO before. So when he gets up there to the top of the Arroyo and he sees this object, he's thinking, you know, cars turned over or something over there. But I think that's a good case, you know, from the classic era to kind of, you know, use as a staple in terms of these kinds of landed UFO and occupant sightings, because even Hector Quintanilla, who was famously more on the skeptical side of things in terms of Blue Book leadership from over the years, even he had said, look, you know, this is a good case, and we can't explain this one. The Air Force has looked at this. We've sent people down there, and we don't have an explanation. We do think that Lonnie Zamora is a very good witness. He's a very credible witness. Here's what he said he saw. In unsensational terms, we're not seeing little green men or alien grays with big bulbous heads. They were humanoid, and they were wearing light-colored suits, and they were outside of the craft. And so if we look at sightings like that, there are actually quite a few from over the years that are remarkably similar in description to what, you know, Zamora said that he saw. You know, what that represents, I don't know. But, I mean, I'm open, as open as maybe we should be, to the possibility that if these are from here, those might have been people. If they aren't from here, then maybe we should be open to the idea that evolutionarily on other planets, life would be very much like what we expect to see here on Earth, because those are very functional forms. And indeed, the humanoid shape may be, throughout the universe, one of the most practical shapes that a life form can take in terms of reaching a position of being able to be intelligent and being able to manipulate tools in the furtherance of technology. Maybe that does make sense, right?
Don't forget the creatures that Barney and Betty Hill encountered.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, they did. And their description is interesting because although most would say, well, you know, they were under hypnosis, and so how sure can we be about what they described? And some of Betty's memories, even before hypnosis, seem to be derived from dreams that she had. That's true, but I mean, we also have to keep in mind that Barney Hill, as they were driving along that night and they observed this object for, I mean, quite some time before they ever claimed to have driven off the side of the road and met the occupants. I mean, Barney Hill observed the craft hovering at an angle over a field through his own pair of binoculars that he was wearing. You know, listeners at home who are familiar with the story may remember him famously saying that he was so frightened that he brought his binoculars down and broke the strap on the binoculars, right? But he had been frightened because he had been looking at what appeared to be a humanoid standing in the window looking down at him from this craft. So it seems to me that he was describing something that he certainly had seen, and that which he said was apart from his memories that, you know, again, were brought out in the hypnosis sessions with Dr. Benjamin Simon, and that also very distinct from Betty Hill's recollections and dreams. He did describe in his waking memory seeing humanoids aboard this UAP craft.
You know, I would say that probably of all the UFO occupant sightings, 99% at least have been reported as humanoid. And, you know, sure, there'd be some differences, you know, hairy humanoids, giant humanoids, but still humanoids. I mean, I can't think of any cases where people reported, you know, like a giant octopus or something along those lines. It's almost inevitably humanoid.
Yeah, that's a good point, Tim. They usually are. In some cases, they're described as being, you know, larger than the average human. In some cases, and again, this going back to the 1970s, wasn't it Ted Phillips, I think, that for the Center for UFO Studies, he compiled a document, an analysis of 1973 humanoid encounters. That's how many were occurring at that time. But among those, there were also some, you know, scattered reports of hairy kind of beings, which more popularly, I guess, resemble what we would call Sasquatch. Again, I'm very, very hesitant to make any kinds of connections between those two purported phenomena. But back to your point, Tim, yeah, generally the descriptions of the occupants in the credible cases involving UFO landings, I mean, they are generally described not only as humanoid, but I would actually say that in a fair number, maybe close to half or more that I've looked at, I mean, they even are sometimes described as essentially resembling humans, right? And that raises a lot of interesting questions. I know that John Keel kind of focused on that and the fact that they were often described as, rather than being like beings or like, you know, humanoids, they were instead described by observers as foreigners. They were human, but they didn't look quite like anybody from around here, in other words. We're not sure where they might have been from, but they were, well, they were foreigners. Well, again, you know, to say that a person looks like they're, you know, from elsewhere is quite a bit different than to say, oh my gosh, it had huge eyes and it was, you know, again, there's a difference between that was a person and, oh, that was an it, right? And so I'm compelled by some of those reports where the occupants who get off these things are actually described as essentially just resembling humans. And then you have those cases where people say, you know, it was just a guy in a military-type suit. He had a flight cap on. The bill was turned up. His sleeves were rolled up. And he, you know, climbs into a hatch, gets on board. The thing silently takes off and goes.
Let's go here. Tim, Gene, Micah. Micah, it's your turn. You're in
the Paracast.
You're listening to GCN. Visit GCNlive.com today.
Do you need a website? Well, you can get a great deal on hosting services with Namecheap's legendary coupon code. They're offering substantial hosting discounts on shared hosting, business hosting, VPS hosting, reseller hosting, and even dedicated servers. Namecheap is preferred by millions. It's backed by a money-back guarantee. Use the coupon code LEGENDARY to cash in on the special deal at Namecheap.com, Namecheap.com.
First came Attack of the Rockoids, and it was a critically acclaimed success. And now there is The Coming of the Protectors. A former military intelligence man is contacted by a space woman in a dream. A dream that turns out to be a nightmare, because evil forces on her distant planet are planning to conquer the Earth. This is gripping science fiction of the classic kind. Attack of the Rockoids and The Coming of the Protectors. Find out more at Rockoids.com. That's Rockoids, Rockoids.com.
Hi, I'm Al Averoa, founder of Knight Strategic Wealth. Inflation is picking up, markets are volatile, and the dream of a comfortable retirement is harder to attain than ever before. Nobody wants to run out of money in retirement. That's why I'm going to share something that your financial advisor doesn't want you to know. With our investment strategy, when the stock market goes up, you earn a market-linked return that locks in every year. And when the stock market goes down, your investments won't lose a dime. There are no unnecessary fees, and it works for your investments, money at a brokerage firm, or even money at a bank. It's simple, it's safe, and that's why savvy investors work with us. Want to learn more? Text FREE to 833-898-0500 and we'll send our retirement readiness kit directly to your phone right now. If you want to help build a retirement portfolio that will go up with the market and never lose money, get our retirement readiness kit today and see how this strategy can help secure your future. Text FREE to 833-898-0500. Text FREE to 833-898-0500.
Get healthy, not high, with 100% pure CBD powerful natural pain relief from Veterans Vitality. GCN listeners, have you ever thought about how CBD may help you? I'm sure you have heard about the many benefits of CBD. Well, here's your opportunity to try before you buy. created by veterans and for everyone who deserves better choices. Our CBD is derived from organic hemp, grown in the USA, and third-party tested. Veterans Vitality CBD saves you as much as 25 to 50% over our competition, and a portion of all sales is contributed to veteran nonprofits and events. Many of our customers have experienced improved quality of life, help with anxiety, PTSD, and overall well-being. Our products do not contain THC. They are safe, non-addictive, effective, and 100% legal. GCN listeners, get your free trial bottle of premium CBD by simply paying shipping and handling at GCNFreeCBD.com. That's GCNFreeCBD.com. Again, GCNFreeCBD.com. Offered by Veterans Vitality Premium CBD.
Extend your life with ExtendoVite.
When your doctor tells you you have bad cholesterol or blockages in the arteries, what do you do? When diet and exercise is not enough, we try medications and hope for the best. For the last two decades, I have been telling people about a natural method to help solve these problems and more. Extendivite can help maintain cardiovascular health and lower blood lipid levels in adults. The seven herbs in Extendivite are known to work together synergistically to get the results we hope for. There are many testimonials on Extendivite's effect on circulatory-related ailments. Get Extendivite today to start your journey back to a healthier life. To order, call 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com or see us on amazon.com.
Extend your life with Extendivite.
This is Jennifer Stein, executive producer of The Disclosure Dialogues. You're listening to The Paracast, the gold standard of paranormal radio.
The form and shape of UFO knots. Micah Hanks, Gene Steinberg, Tim Swartz. And the question, of course, that we're asking here is the form and shape of ET. What do they look like? Then again, maybe they've created a race of robots to look like us to be more acceptable to us, or because they're so advanced they could take on different shapes. You know, back, like the movie Contact, the movie with Jodie Foster, Contact, where E.T. allegedly appears in the form of her dad because otherwise we couldn't accept what it looked like.
Peter Robbins and I were talking together a number of years ago in New York, and I'd asked him about another interesting case, and this is a bit of an outlier, even though many consider it sort of one of those sort of cornerstones in ufology. And I would, too, for various reasons. I'm talking about the Travis Walton abduction experience. I've met Travis many times. He's always seemed very credible. Very little about his story has changed. Rather than it becoming more and more elaborate over time, if anything, I've seen Travis many times go out in his lectures to say, here's what really happened. Hollywood really embellished that story for the film version, tried to make it into a horror movie. I don't even think it was an abduction, I've heard him say. He says, you know, I don't think it was an abduction. It was more like a rescue mission because underneath this craft, the thing, you know, zapped me. I don't think that was intentional. And they probably saved my life, whoever was on board that craft. Which brings us, of course, to the descriptions of the occupants.
We know about Fire in the Sky and how the encounter with E.T. was sensationalized. And I think, as I recall, what Tracy Tourme, the producer, said on the Paracast is that they were told by the studio they had to change that because otherwise it would be too much like some other movies. So it was a creative decision on the part of Hollywood, which quite often makes creative decisions that have nothing to do with factual content.
Yes, indeed. I've spoken at least maybe once or twice with Tracy about that at various conferences where we've run into each other over the years. And I've also seen a version of it that was that there had been the original screenplay of the film, right? But that the screenplay, which was based on Travis's actual experience, you know, the producers were like, ah, this just won't be scary enough. You know, we're going to have to, you know, change things around. And so they did. But all that said, in the actual account that Travis gives, which is, you know, presented in his book, he not only describes seeing what we would popularly call grays, and again, an interesting side note with regard to that is that they weren't really the stereotypical description that we receive of, you know, the gray skin, the completely black, you know, almond-shaped eyes. The descriptions that he gave and also the illustrations, the renderings in the book, they seem to have pupilled eyes in that case. which was always interesting to me, almost as interesting as the fact that after his initial waking up and encountering immediately these smallish beings that were more like the alien greys of popular mythology, then a man in a spacesuit of some kind, a tight-fitting, you know, suit with a sort of helmet, comes into the room, doesn't say anything, leads him out of the room. I've often wondered about that case because here you had a unique blend of two different kinds of beings that Travis said that he encountered, and this coming from one of the most, again, seemingly credible cases on record. So Peter and I were talking about it one day, and I said, you know, Peter, how do you rectify that? How do you reconcile the two different individuals on board the craft? And he said, you know, I've wondered sometimes if initially when Travis woke up, what he saw, again, the aliens, what very much seemed like aliens to him, were how they really appeared, and that he's in shock, and thereafter when he says a person comes and leads him off the craft and he thereafter encounters what look like people to him, that this is his own mind trying to reconcile with what he's seeing in a way that seemed less frightening to him. Kind of in keeping with what you're describing there, Gene, you know, that's interesting interpretation. We might also say that what if there were a technology that would allow them to make themselves look different so that a human would, you know, feel less intimidated by what they were experiencing. That's another interpretation. Another interpretation might simply be that there were two different kinds of beings on board that craft. But here again, back to Tim's point, they're all humanoids. This is an interesting area in terms of historical ufology for me, because in this modern dialogue, people seem to have, I mean, almost like a nonsensical aversion to wanting to discuss the idea of occupants. But this isn't the first time in history that that's happened. If we go back to the early days of NICAP, again, the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, they were also very, you know, hesitant to get into discussion of humanoid encounters for a time. But then by the time the UFO evidence comes out, and they're presenting what they are considering some of the best cases that they'd collected and that were available on the record, then we start seeing, you know, some of these humanoid encounters. The famous, what was it, the Cisco Grove encounter was one of those involving a hunter who had been lost, and he starts signaling to an object that he thinks is a helicopter, and then he hears something, you know, whacking through the bushes, making its way up the hill. He thinks that there's some people on the way up the hill. And initially he sees these two people, he said, in these kind of jumpsuits, kind of light-colored suits. It was dark out, but he didn't describe any kind of strange features, just that there were people. And then this other individual comes up the hill, and he describes it as a robot that sort of belches this gas that would cause him to almost black out, and he ended up using his belt to strap himself to this tree he was up in. And he was wearing his normal clothing underneath his hunting gear, and he started removing the hunting gear and lighting fire to it and dropping it to try and get these beings to leave him alone. That was his story. This eventually ends up actually being included in a NICAP publication. And so historically, there's an interesting parallel there where early on, both NICAP and also Blue Book, because again, they would often say that if they were given, and I remember Jacques Vallée complaining about this in his writings over the years, Blue Book investigators, when they received occupant reports, they immediately put those in the psychological category. You know, they didn't give me any actual consideration. They wouldn't take them seriously. So we seem to have kind of come full circle back to that attitude among people where if someone says that they have had an experience where there is a humanoid, or if we even look at the historical cases and entertain the possibility that there are actual beings, occupants, who are controlling some of these craft, they act like that's crazy. But at some point, we may have to really look at that and try to do so as soberly and sanely as possible if we are to try and understand the totality of what UAP represents.
You know, there may have been an aversion in the United States to taking a serious look at occupant sightings, but you look at the 1953 UFO flap, especially in France and Spain, where there were hundreds of UFO occupant sightings. And, you know, I mean, this was really early on in the whole modern UFO era. I mean, you know, we've got all these cases today, yet a lot of it was virtually ignored here in the States.
Indeed, I think that different, you know, countries and different investigative groups at times in different eras throughout the years, I mean, they have all kind of approached the problem a little differently in their own unique ways. I think if we think about the early work done by Aimé Michel, of course, you know, the famous French ufologist and really a pioneer who had been very influential on Dr. Vallée's work and others, you know, we see a lot of, I think, open-mindedness, because at that time people were saying, hey, This seems to be a new phenomenon. It's just a matter of time before we figure out what this is, and we'll learn, maybe the hard way, whether this is just a survey of this planet or if indeed they are about to invade. When you go back and you read Forbidden Science, where Vallée was, again, in the early years, 1950s and 60s, talking about this, and how his colleagues would come to him, and on one occasion, one had said, I think that the invasion could be imminent. I mean, we are looking at virtually any day. And I think it's hard for the modern researcher, especially the more skeptically inclined one, and I try to be very skeptical myself when warranted, but it seems difficult to look back for many of us today. Granted, I wasn't born in 1973, so it's especially difficult for me to look back to a year where we had a sightings wave that was so historic, so many sightings, so many alleged encounters, so many sightings of these occupants, humanoids, abduction cases like the Pascagoula incident, of course, was logged that year, and a lot of others, too. It's difficult to look back and see how much activity was happening then and compare that with today. And again, I've seen in recent years a lot of researchers prior to 2017 especially saying, where'd all the UFO sightings go? We seem to be in a lull. And then the military comes out and starts saying, oh, no, actually, if anything, there's been an uptick in sightings of things, surveilling airspace, controlled airspace, and we want to get to the bottom of who might be controlling these things. And so it's interesting to see the military civilian researchers in recent years. It's easy to see, I think, the way that modern researchers look at this and they say, what happened to all of the sightings? And then the military coming around and saying, oh, no, we actually see more of these things than we ever have. That's kind of a paradox, in my opinion, and I find it a little strange. It must be kind of difficult for many people to reconcile with the, again, on the one hand, some claiming in recent years, oh, sightings seems to have really kind of fallen off the map. We don't see things like what we were experiencing back in 1973, versus the military saying, actually, due to the apparent increase in sightings, we're really stepping up our game. We want to get to the bottom of what these things are.
We've got more to come with Micah, Gene, and Tim. You're in
the Paracast.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Be sure to visit GCNLive.com today.
Attack of the Rockoids has been well received by critics and readers alike. It's a thrill-a-minute story you'll never forget. A former U.S. military intelligence officer is haunted by intense dreams about a beautiful woman pleading for his help after a terrible battle in outer space. But the dreams turn out to be true and thrust him into a telepathic love affair with a woman whose faraway planet is intent on destroying the Earth. And now the gripping tale continues in The Coming of the Protectors. It's the second book of the Rockoids trilogy, a galaxy-spanning adventure that pits our hapless heroes against powerful, fanatical enemies that threaten the lives of freedom-loving beings everywhere. Attack of the Rockoids and The Coming of the Protectors, classic science fiction at its best, available now. For more details, visit Rockoids.com. That's Rockoids.com.
Jake was in big trouble with the IRS. He owed how much?
$92,000.
Ouch. And the IRS left no room for Jake to breathe.
They put a lien on my house, took all the money out of my bank account, took money out of my paychecks. So it was a nightmare.
He needed help fast.
I figured that all these companies were the same until I called Federal Tax Management. You could just tell they knew what they were talking about. Right then and there, I felt like I had some hope.
Stop the liens, levies, and garnishments fast and qualify for one of several special IRS programs that could reduce or even eliminate your tax debt. So, how'd it go for Jake?
They did what they said they would do. They came through for me. I ended up saving an unbelievable amount. I was so jazzed. I was extremely happy.
If you owe more than $10,000 in back taxes, take Jake's advice.
Give Federal Tax Management a phone call. If they help me, they can help anybody.
Call the Federal Tax Management Hotline now. 800-503-8625. 800-503-8625. 800-503-8625.